Orff Schneider wanted to place his discoveries at the disposal of an archaeological museum in India, and when the Chinese communists invaded Tibet, we took the collections, carefully packed, away with us. Not long afterward I had an unexpected opportunity to get out of Lhasa and learn something of a new part of the country. Some friends had asked me to look at their estates and make suggestions for their improvement. They had managed to get the government to grant me leave of absence, and I was able to visit their properties one after another. The conditions which I found were completely medieval. The peasants still used wooden ploughs with an iron share. These were drawn by dzows. The dzow is a cross between an ox and a yak, and is a very good draft animal. It looks very like the yak, and the milk of the cows, which has a high fat content, is much prized. One of the problems that the Tibetans have done little to solve is that of watering their fields. The springtime is generally very dry, but no one thinks of carrying water onto the land from the snow-swollen brooks and rivers. The estates of the landed gentry are often very large. It sometimes takes a whole day to ride across a property. Many serfs are attached to every estate. They are given a few fields to cultivate for their own profit, but are obliged to spend a certain time working for their landlord. The estate managers, who are often merely trusted servants of the landlord, boss the serfs like little kings. Their own master lives in Lhasa, where he works for the government and has little time to bother about the property. However, his public services are frequently rewarded by gifts of land, and there are noble officials to whom in the course of their careers as many as 20 large farms have been given. The official who falls from grace is equally likely to be dispossessed of his estates, which pass into the hands of the government. Nevertheless, there are many families who have been living in their castles for centuries and bear territorial names. Their ancestors often built these fortresses on the rocky promontories that dominate the valleys. When built on the plain, they are surrounded by moats, but these are now dry and empty. The ancient weapons preserved in the castles testify to the warlike spirit of their former lords, who had constantly to be ready to defend themselves against the attacks of the Mongols. I was days and weeks on my tour, and riding through unknown country was a welcome change after life in Lhasa. I was not always on horseback. During part of the time I was floating in a yakskin boat down the mighty Brahmaputra, stopping to visit monasteries that attracted me and taking photographs. When I got back to Lhasa, it was already winter. The small tributary of the Kaichu was already frozen, and that caused us to think of something new. With a small group of friends, including the Dalai Lama's brother, we founded a skating club. We were not the first people in Tibet to go in for this sport. The staff of the British legation had practiced skating to the immense astonishment of the natives. We were actually their heirs, because we acquired their skates, which they had bequeathed to their servants when they left. Our first efforts were very funny, and we always had a good many onlookers to laugh at us and to wonder who would be the next to fall on his head or break through the ice. Parents noted with horror the enthusiasm of their children, determined at all costs to learn how to skate. The old-fashioned, unsporting noble families could not conceive that anyone would wantonly tie a knife to the sole of his boot and slither about on it. Tibet prepares for trouble. The Dalai Lama had heard from his brother about our new sport, but unfortunately our ring was invisible from the roof of the potala. He would have dearly liked to see us disporting ourselves on the ice, but as that was impossible, he sent me his moving picture camera with instructions to film the rink and the skaters for him. As I had never taken a film picture, I made a careful study of the prospectus and instructions before going to work. Then I made my picture and had the film sent to India by the Foreign Ministry to be developed. In 2 months it was in the hands of the Dalai Lama. It had come out very well. Through this film I made my first personal contact with the younger ruler of Tibet. It seems curious that a product of the 20th century should have been the starting point of a relation that, in spite of all conventions, eventually became a close friendship. Soon after this, Lobsang Samten told me that his brother wished me to film different ceremonies and festival scenes for him. I was astonished to see how great was his interest in these pictures. He always sent me the most precise instructions, sometimes in writing and sometimes verbally through Lobsang Samton. He advised me how to make the most favorable use of the light in certain positions, or, maybe, he would send word to say that this or that ceremony was due to start punctually. I, too, was able to send a message telling him when during a procession to keep his eyes fixed in the direction of my camera. Naturally, I did my best to avoid being conspicuous during these ceremonies. He, too, regarded this as important and told me to keep in the background, and if I could not do this, to refrain from taking a picture. Obviously, I could not avoid being seen, but as soon as it became known that I was filming and photographing under instructions from His Holiness, I was not interrupted. In fact, the dreaded dob-dobs often made the crowd give way to let me have a free field of vision, and when I asked them to pose for me, they obeyed like lambs. In this way I was enabled to make numbers of unique pictures of religious ceremonies. In addition to the moving picture camera, I always had my Leica with me and took many photographs of unusual scenes for myself. I took some beautiful pictures of the cathedral. The Tsuglag Kang, as it is called, was built in the 7th century and contains the most precious statue of Buddha in Tibet. The origin of this temple dates from the reign of the famous king Srungtsen Gampo. His two wives were princesses, and both belonged to the Buddhist faith. One of them came from Nepal and founded the second greatest temple of Lhasa, the Ranmok, while the other was a Chinese and brought the golden idol with her from China. The king, who followed the ancient religion, was converted by his wives to Buddhism, which became the state religion. He then caused the cathedral to be built as a home for the golden idol. This building has the same defects as the Potala. Externally it is grand and imposing, but internally it is dark, full of corners, and unfriendly. It is packed with treasure, which is daily added to by refresh offerings. Every minister on appointment must buy new silk embroidered costumes for the statues of the saints, and a butter dish of solid gold. Loads of butter are burned unceasingly in the lamps, and in summer and winter the air is full of rancid smelling smoke. The only creatures who benefit by the offerings are the mice, which climb in thousands up and down the heavy silk curtains and gorge on the butter and tsampa in the bowls. It is dark in the temple, not a ray of light penetrates from the outside, and only the butter lamps on the altars shed their flickering gleam. The entrance to the Holy of Holies is usually closed by a heavy iron curtain, which is raised only at stated hours. In a dark, narrow passage, I found a bell hanging from the roof. I could hardly believe my eyes when I saw on it the inscription "Dumb Lord Damas." It was probably the last surviving relic of the chapel that the Catholic missionaries had built in Lhasa many centuries ago. They had not been able to maintain themselves in Tibet and had been obliged to leave. It may be that the preservation of this bell in their cathedral is due to the deep respect that Tibetans feel for all religions. I would gladly have learned more about the chapel of the Jesuits, but no trace of the building survives. In the evening the cathedral is filled with worshippers. The curtain is raised, and a long queue waits before the altar of the Buddha. Each worshipper touches the statue with bowed head and makes a small offering. Holy water, tinted with saffron, is poured into his cupped hand by a monk. Part of this he drinks, and the rest he sprinkles over his head. Many monks spend their whole lives in the cathedral. Their duty is to keep watch over the treasures and to fill the butter lamps. An attempt was once made to install electric light in the cathedral, but a fire occurred owing to a short circuit, and everyone connected with the installation was dismissed. So there was no more talk of artificial light. Before the cathedral is a terrace of flagstones, polished like mirrors and hollowed out by the prostrations of worshippers over 1,000 years. When one looks at these hollows and recognizes the expression of deep devotion on the faces of worshippers, one understands why a Christian mission could never succeed in Lhasa. A lama from the Drepung on a visit to Rome to convert the Catholics would recognize the futility of his mission when he saw the steps of the holy staircase worn down by the knees of countless pilgrims, and would leave the Vatican with resignation. Christianity and Buddhism have much in common. They are both founded on the belief in happiness in another world, and both preach humility in this life. But there is a difference as things are today. In Tibet, one is not hunted from morning till night by the calls of civilization. Here one has time to occupy oneself with religion and to call one's soul one's own. Here it is religion that occupies most of the life of the individual, as it did in the West during the Middle Ages. Beggars take up their station by the cathedral door. They know very well that man is charitable and considerate when he is in the presence of God. In Tibet, as in most other places, beggars are a public nuisance. While I was building my dam, the government determined to put the sturdy beggars to work. They rounded up the 1,000 beggars of Lhasa and picked out 700 men who were fit for employment. These were put on the job, and received food and pay for their work. On the next day only half of them turned up, and a few days later they were all absent. It is not lack of work or dire necessity that makes these people beggars, nor, in most cases, bodily infirmity. It is pure laziness. Begging offers a good livelihood in Tibet, and no one turns a beggar from the door. And if a beggar gets only some tsampa and a penny or so from each client, the produce of 2 hours' work suffices to keep him going for the day. Then he sits idly by the wall and dozes happily in the sunshine. Many beggars have horrible diseases that deserve sympathy, but they exploit their deformities by thrusting them on the notice of the passerby. One of the most attractive features in Tibetan life is the habit of going to meet, and seeing off, one's friends. When anyone goes away, his friends often put a tent on his road several miles out of town and wait for him there with a meal to speed him on his way. The departing friend is not allowed to go till he has been loaded with white scarves and good wishes. When he comes back, the same ceremony is observed. It sometimes happens that he is welcomed at several places on his way home. In the morning, maybe, he first catches sight of the potala, but on his way into the town he is held up at tent after tent by his welcoming friends, and it is evening before he arrives in Lhasa, his modest caravan swollen to stately proportions by his friends and their servants. He comes home with the happy feeling that he has not been forgotten. When foreigners arrive, they are met by a representative from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who conveys the greetings of the minister to them and arranges for their lodgings and entertainment. New ambassadors are received with military honors and presented with silk scarves by a delegate of the cabinet. In Lhasa there is a special quarter for guests, where they and their servants and animals are accommodated, and where they find gifts awaiting them on arrival. It would be true to say that in no country in the world are travelers treated with greater attention and hospitality. During the war, airplanes on their way from India to China often lost their way. This is probably the most difficult air route in the world, as the passage of the Himalayas puts a heavy strain on the skill and experience of the pilot, who, once he has lost his bearings, finds it very difficult to right himself owing to the inadequacy of the maps of Tibet. One night the droning of motors was heard over the holy city and caused general alarm. 2 days later news came from Siam that 5 Americans had landed there in parachutes. The government invited them to come to Lhasa on their way back to India. The airmen must have been greatly astonished at being received in tents some way out of the city and offered a hearty welcome accompanied by butter tea and scarves. They said in Lhasa that they had lost their bearings completely and that the wings of their plane had grazed the snow slopes of the Nenshenth Hanglhe. After this they had turned back, but finding that they had too little fuel to reach India, they decided to scrap their plane and jump. Except for a sprained ankle or two and a broken arm, they came down safely. After a short stay in Lhasa, they were convoyed by the government to the Indian frontier, riding horses and as comfortable as one can be on trek in Tibet. The crews of other American planes that came down in Tibet during the war were not so lucky. In eastern Tibet the remains of 2 crashed planes were found. The members of the crews had all been killed. Another plane must have crashed south of the Himalayas in a province whose inhabitants are savage jungle folk. These people are not Buddhists but naked savages reputed to use poisoned arrows. From time to time they come out of their forests to exchange skins and musk for salt and beads. On one of these occasions, they offered objects that could have come only from an American airplane. Nothing more was ever heard of this disaster. I would have liked to go in search of the site of the accident, but the distance was too great. The political situation of Tibet was gradually getting worse. The Chinese had already solemnly declared in Peking that they were going to liberate Tibet. Even in Lhasa, people were under no illusions about the gravity of this threat. In China, the Reds had always carried out what they had taken in hand. The Tibetan government set to work feverishly to reorganize the army under the supervision of a cabinet minister. Tibet had a standing army, to which every district contributed its quota in proportion to the number of the inhabitants. This conception of compulsory military service differs from ours in that the state is interested only in numbers and not in individuals. A man called up for service can buy a substitute. Often enough, these substitutes remain in the army all their lives. The military instructors have served in India and understand the use of modern weapons. Hitherto, the words of command had been given in a mixture of Tibetan, Urdu, and English. The new defense minister's first decision was that all orders were to be given in Tibetan. A new national anthem was composed to replace God Save the Queen, the tune of which had hitherto been played at important military parades. The text consisted of a glorification of the independence of Tibet and a tribute to its illustrious ruler, the Dalai Lama. The flat pasture lands around Lhasa were transformed into training grounds for the troops. New regiments were formed, and the National Assembly decided to call on the richer classes to furnish and equip another 1,000 men. It was left to them to enlist in person or to find substitutes. Courses were organized for the training as officers of monks and civil officials. There was a great deal of patriotic enthusiasm. In the former days, people had not bothered much about the army. The district communities had had to supply their contingents with provisions and supplementary pay. Now the authorities recognized the importance of regular organization, and established fixed rates of pay for officers and men. It was not easy, at the outset, to supply the needs of the new army. The whole transport system was overworked. The necessary grain had often to be fetched from far distant depots. These storehouses, which are to be found in all regions where crops are plentiful, are huge, windowless, stone buildings ventilated by holes in the walls. Here the grain can lie for decades without going bad, owing to the dryness of the air. But now they were quickly emptied, for provisions would have to be stored in the neighborhood of the fighting line if it came to war. Nevertheless, the country was not threatened with a shortage of foodstuffs. If a wall were built around Tibet, no one would suffer from cold or starvation, as everything necessary for the needs of the 3 million inhabitants is found in the country in one form or another. The military kitchens supplied plentiful meals, and the soldiers' pay enabled them to buy cigarettes and chang. The troops were contented. In the Tibetan army, it is easy to recognize the difference between officers and men. The higher his rank, the more gold decorations an officer wears. There seem to be no proper regulations about dress. I once saw a general who, in addition to his gold epaulettes, had a collection of glittering objects pinned on his breast. He had probably spent too much time looking at foreign illustrated papers and had devoted himself accordingly, for there are no Tibetan military medals. Instead of mentions and distinctions, the Tibetan soldier receives more tangible rewards. After a victory, he has a right to the booty, and saluting is the general rule. He is, however, obliged to deliver the weapons he has captured. A good example of the utility of this system can be found in the battles against the bandits. The local bonpos are entitled to call on the government for aid when they can no longer cope with the robbers. Small military detachments are then sent to help them. In spite of the ruthless manner in which the bandits fight, service in these commandos is very popular. The soldiers have their eye on the plunder and ignore the danger. The soldiers' right to the spoils of war has been the cause of a great deal of trouble. In a case with which I was personally connected, it cost the lives of several persons. When the Chinese communists occupied Turkestan, the American consul, a Chinaman, with a young American student named Besak and three white Russians, fled to Tibet, having first requested the U.S. Embassy in India to ask the Tibetan government for travel facilities. Messengers were sent from Lhasa in all directions to instruct the frontier posts and patrols to make no difficulties for the fugitives. The party traveled in a small caravan over the Kunlun Mountains. Their camels stood the journey well, and they obtained fresh meat by shooting wild asses. By ill luck, the government messenger was late in arriving at the spot where the party was to cross the frontier. Without challenging or finding out who was approaching them, the soldiers of the outpost, tempted by the sight of a dozen heavily laden camels, fired on the caravan, killing on the spot the American consul and two of the Russians. The third Russians were wounded, and only Besak escaped unhurt. He was taken prisoner and brought with the wounded man to the nearest district governor. On the way, the two men were insulted and threatened by the soldiers, who had first shared among the spoils and had been overjoyed to find such valuable objects as field glasses and cameras. Before they reached the next bonpo, the government messenger came up with the escort, with orders to treat the Americans and their party as guests of the government. This caused a change of attitude. The soldiers outdid one another in politeness, but the damage could not be undone. The governor sent a report to Lhasa, and the authorities, horrified by the news, did their utmost to express their regret in every possible way. An Indian-trained hospital orderly was sent with presents to meet Besak and his wounded companion. They were invited to come to Lhasa and asked to bear witness for the prosecution against the soldiers, who had already been arrested. A high official who spoke a little English rode out to meet the approaching travelers. I attached myself to him, thinking that it might be some comfort to the young American to have a white man to talk to. I also hoped to convince him that the government could not be blamed for the incident, which it deeply regretted. We met the young man in pouring rain. He was as tall as a binpole and completely dwarfed his little Tibetan pony. I could well imagine how he felt. The little caravan had been months on the road, always in flight from enemies and exposed to dangers, and their first meeting with the people of the country in which they sought asylum brought three of their party to their death. New clothes and shoes were waiting for them in a tent by the wayside, and in Lhasa they were put up in a garden house with a book and a servant to look after them. Fortunately, the Russian, Vasilyev, was not dangerously wounded and was soon able to hobble about the garden on crutches. They remained for a month in Lhasa, during which time I made friends with Besak. He bore no grudge against the country that had at first received him so ill. He asked only that the soldiers who had ill-treated him on the way to the district governor should be punished. He was requested to be present at the execution of the sentence, so as to make sure there was no deception. When he saw the floggings, he asked that the number of lashes should be reduced. He took photographs of the scene, which later appeared in Life as a testimonial to the correct attitude of the Tibetan government. Everything was done to pay the last honors to the dead according to Western customs. So it is that three wooden crosses stand today over their graves in the Chenghthang. Besak was received by the Dalai Lama, and afterward left for Sikkim, where he was met by fellow countrymen. The troubled times brought many fugitives to Tibet, but none were so unlucky as this party. Another camel caravan that came through the Chenghthang belonged to a Mongolian prince, who brought with him his two wives, one a Pole and the other a Mongol. I was full of admiration for these two women who had performed such a tremendous journey, and my astonishment was not lessened when I saw their two charming children, who had stood the hardships of the road equally well. It is clear that in these critical times the government desired to mobilize not only the material means of defense but also the spiritual force of the people. For this end, religion, the most powerful element in the life of the country, had to be invoked. New ordinances and new officials were employed in the service of this policy. The officials were given plenty of money and a free hand to organize the campaign. All the monks in Tibet were ordered to attend public services at which the Kaniyur, the Tibetan Bible, was to be read aloud. New prayer flags and prayer wheels were set up everywhere. Rare and powerful amulets were brought out of old chests. Offerings were doubled, and on all the mountains, incense fires burned, while the winds, turning the prayer wheels, carried supplications to the protecting deities in all the corners of heaven. The people believed with rock-like faith that the power of religion would suffice to protect their independence. In the meantime, Radio Peiping was already sending out messages in Tibetan promising that Tibet would soon be freed. More people than ever streamed to the religious festivals, which, in the early days of 1950, surpassed in pomp and splendor anything I had ever seen. It seemed as if the whole population of Tibet had gathered, in pious enthusiasm, in the narrow streets of Lhasa. But I could not banish the thought that their touching faith would never move the golden gods. If no help came from outside, Tibet would soon be roughly awakened from its peaceful slumbers. The Dalai Lama had again charged me to take pictures of the festivals, so I was able to see everything from a point of vantage. 4 weeks after the Great New Year festival, there is a small prayer festival, which lasts for only 10 days, but perhaps surpasses the great festival in splendor. At this moment, the spring verdure is beginning to show, and the town presents an unforgettable aspect. The festival is the highlight of the year for the inhabitants of Sho. For 2 hours an immense banner hangs down from the potala of the Sho quarter. This banner is certainly the largest in the world. It takes 50 monks to carry it to its place and unfold it. It is made of fine, heavy silk and adorned with figures of the gods in bright colors. When at last it floats over the town from the potala, a gay procession moves from Tsuglag Kang to Sho, and there, after solemn ceremonies, breaks up. It is followed by a curious ritual. Groups of monks perform primitive dances, gyrating slowly to the rolling of drums. They wear masks and are hung with rare, carved ornaments of bone. The people stare entranced at the uncanny figures. Sometimes a whisper runs through the crowd. Someone thinks he has seen the Dalai Lama standing on the roof of the potala 300 feet above their heads and looking down through his telescope at the performance. Sho, which stands at the foot of the potala, is the home of the state printing press, a high, dark building from which never a sound issues into the outer world. There is no humming of machines, and only the voices of the monks echo through the halls. Wooden blocks lie piled on long shelves. They are used only when a new book is printed. The preparation of a new book entails endless work. The monks must first cut out small wooden boards by hand, as there are no sawmills here, and then carve the squiggly letters one by one in the birch wood boards. When they are ready, the tablets are carefully placed in order. Instead of printer's ink, they use a mixture of soot, which the monks made by burning yak dung. Most of them get black from head to foot during their work. At last, the separate plates are printed off on handmade Tibetan paper. The books are not bound. They consist of loose pages printed on both sides and enclosed by two carved wooden covers. One can either order books in the printing press or buy them from one of the booksellers in the parka. At home, they are generally kept in silk wrappers and carefully looked after. As their subject is always religious, they are treated with great respect and usually placed on the house altar. In every better class house, one finds the complete Bible, as well as the 200 volumes of commentaries. So much reverence is paid to these books that nobody would think of placing one of the volumes on a chair. On the other hand, they think little of the books that interest us. I once found a valuable book on the Tibetan language in a very unsuitable place. The early pages were missing. I took the book away and wrote in the missing pages from another copy, very pleased with my find. The price of Tibetan books depends on the quality of the paper used. The Bible with its commentaries costs as much as a good house or a dozen yaks. There is another very large printing press at Narthang, in the neighborhood of Shigatse, and almost every monastery has the apparatus for printing books on local saints and the annals of their lamasseries. The whole culture of Tibet is inspired by religion, as it used to be in the early days in Western civilization. The masterpieces of architecture and sculpture, of poetry and painting, glorify the faith and increase the power and reputation of the church. There is as yet no conflict between religion and science, and consequently the content of most books is a combination of religious lore and philosophic knowledge and wisdom gathered from experience. poems and songs are mainly manuscript, written on loose leaves and not gathered into collections. The poems of the 6th Dalai Lama form an exception to this rule. They are printed as a volume. I bought a copy in the bazaar and have often read them through. They give perfect expression to the poet's yearning for love.